mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
For word of mouth.
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 Word of mouth. Word of mouth.
Coming up on Word of Mouth, defecting from a diagnosis, a grown-up realizes that the Asperger's label given to him as a teen was actually typical adolescent isolation. And a convict-turned Ivy League professor gives us an insider's view of the Black Panther movement.
Kids join gangs these days, mm-hmm. looking for swagger, looking right. for family. And there is no one there saying, this is about being politically aware, this is going to be about community service, this is going to be about the real path to manhood and womanhood and family.
And we'll look ahead to Westminster with the standard spectacle and unexpected treachery of show dogs and professional pooch handling.
Look at a Bichon or look at a poodle. I mean, mm-hmm. these are dogs that are hairsprayed like the cast of Jersey Shore. I mean, unbelievably poofed out. It's a rule that no one honors.
I'm Virginia Prescott. The power of ideas to the people, coming up on Word of Mouth after the news. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up, a former Black Panther's journey from church kid to fugitive to Ivy League professor. And a documentary reveals the painful legacy of a family's decision to save face in a small Kansas town. And a dog-loving journalist peers into the pampering, consuming, scandalous, and charming show dog circuit. We'll hear his insights and ideas on what to watch for when Westminster kicks off next week. But first, the mysterious neurological condition known as Asperger's syndrome may soon be history. Proposals for the fifth edition of the Psychiatric Bible, the Diagnostic and Statistic Manual of Mental Disorders, or the DSM-5, recommend filing Asperger's under the general category of autism spectrum disorder. For those already diagnosed, the change would alter or at least complicate a part of their identity. Benjamin Nugent is an assistant professor of English and director of creative writing at Southern New Hampshire University. His diagnosis of Asperger's was taken away for a different reason, namely that he doesn't have it. Benjamin recently wrote about the misdiagnosis in a New York Times op-ed and joins us now in the studio. Benjamin, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
How old are you when you were diagnosed?
Well, you know, I was sitting at the table with my mom when I was 17. My mom was a psychologist who thought a lot about Asperger's, and we went through the DSM definition, if I remember correctly, and I said, oh, well, that sounds like me. And I think that was when it was more or less settled in her mind, or began to be settled in her mind.
What kind of symptoms did you say yes to on the checklist?
Well, the symptoms are pretty vague, so a lot of people could say yes to them. But I had intensive interests, which included playing guitar in my room and listening to music and reading. And I wasn't very good at making friends. I had a few friends, but not very many. I wasn't a recluse, but I was, you know, not a popular kid. Mm-hmm. And, you know, really what qualifies you to have Asperger's in the DSM-4, which is still the rule that people have, is essentially a lack of social skill and intense interests.
Mm-hmm. And your mom, who was a researcher at the mm-hmm. time, or very interested in what was going on in the world of Asperger's, you appeared in a film, in fact, mm-hmm. one of these short film strips of, mm-hmm. you know, information about Asperger's. How did you react to that diagnosis? Did you think, oh, okay, this explains everything? You know, was it kind of liberating, validating? Did you kind of embrace it?
No, I mean, I don't think I understood what Asperger's syndrome was very well. Until my mother actually showed me the educational video she had made. And then when I saw the other subjects who were being interviewed, I was immediately like, what? You know? Mm-hmm. It was that kind of reaction because they were very obviously mildly autistic. They would kind of spout information about sea creatures, for example, yeah. at length. And I was pretty sure at that point that that wasn't me.
Well, do you think your mother's occupation kind of led her in that direction? Or, you know, I mean, I think
sure.
a lot of parents have anxiety if their kids are not normalized in the sense that maybe they have ideas of.
Sure. You know, it's so hard for parents right now because we're in a place with our understanding of the human mind where we don't really know whether something's neurologically based or socially based. You know, that is whether you're unpopular just because you're in high school mm-hmm. and you're kind of weird looking and into unconventional things, or if your neurology is actually different from other people's. And so I think parents are constantly trying to walk this very wavy, thin path between acknowledging if a child is neurologically different from most other children on one hand and overdiagnosing on the other hand.
So when did you realize that you'd been overdiagnosed, that you did not really have Asperger's syndrome?
I think it was when I saw that video. You know, also, like most people, I grew up a lot between ages 17 and 22. And so I think maybe once I'd sort of established myself in New York City and met other people who were more like me, then I also came into a greater sense that it wasn't that I had a neurological condition that made it hard for me to find friends. It was that I hadn't moved to New York yet.
Yeah. You're now the author of a book called American Nerd. Now, that, you know, you probably met a lot of people in New York who were sort of a lot like you. Is there an overlap, do you think, between these kind of elements of, you know, geek culture, as it's called, and the current criteria for Asperger's?
You know, there's a lot of overlap between a kid who has intense interests and somebody who might be diagnosable as mildly autistic. And I think the difference is that, or it perhaps should be the difference in a new DSM, would be that a kid who understands what's going on with social interaction but still isn't popular should not be diagnosed with an autism spectrum disorder. The distinction should be whether you fail to understand what's going on socially and therefore can't make friends, can't be socially competent, so to speak.
Well, let's talk about that diagnosis, because it's created huge ripples in the neurological and Asperger's study and autism study communities. The proposal for the DSM-5 it recommends folding Asperger's into what they call autism spectrum disorder, which would change the criteria for the diagnosis. This is Danya Jekyll. She's director of the Asperger's Association of New England talking about it.
Mm-hmm. People are concerned that if there's no Asperger syndrome, they're going to lose that diagnosis and they're going to lose their identity, their service, and their community. 18, 20 years ago, when there was a diagnosis of autism and there was no diagnosis of Asperger's, there were many, many families who were extremely isolated. They had children who were struggling, but there was no place for them. There was no community for them. The parents felt alone. They didn't understand how to parent. There were no resources. And we feel that the changes to the DSM-5, the proposed changes, could bring us back into the time when there are really no services, no community, no help for those folks with Asperger syndrome. And we really don't want to go back in time.
Well, Benjamin, you talked a little bit about what you think the distinction should be, you know, not just social awkwardness, or maybe an awareness of social awkwardness, I guess, would be kind of the barometer. Listening to what Danya was just talking about, I mean, this is a much larger issue. You went through this personally. You probably have an acute awareness of what's going on sort of politically or in the research community. Any thoughts on what she said?
Yeah, I think it is really important for people who are on the autism spectrum to have communities and to have services. And she makes an incredibly valid point. No kid who has mild autism should go untreated. And that's one of the reasons why I say very explicitly in my Time's Op-Ed page that the intentions of my mother and her colleague were incredibly noble, that there's very important work to be done in destigmatizing Asperger's syndrome and autism spectrum disorders of all kinds, and in building communities and creating services for people who have it. What's also important, however, and I think this is less talked about, is that the current outlines of what Asperger's syndrome is are so vague that we don't really understand what we're talking about when we talk about Asperger's, that we don't understand typically when you and I say to each other over lunch, oh yeah, that guy's kind of Asperger's-y, what we mean. You know, it's really entered pop culture and it's become part of our lexicon and people throw it around without any understanding of what they're saying or any consensus as to the real definition. And so it seems to me that the diagnosis probably should be modified in such a way so that there can still be a community, there can still be services for people who are on the autism spectrum, but it's defined so precisely that any old nerd isn't an Aspie.
Well, thank you so much for joining us and
telling
your story. Benjamin Nugent, Assistant Professor of English and Director of Creative Writing at Southern New Hampshire University, author of American Nerd, The Story of My People. You'll find links to his New York Times op-ed, to the Asperger's Association of New England website, and to the press release outlining proposed changes to the DSM-5. That's all at wordofmouthradio.org. Love to hear what you think as well. Should the criteria for Asperger's diagnosis be narrowed? Have you ever wondered if your social anxieties deserve a diagnosis, or if your diagnosis is overblown? Let us know on Facebook or send us a tweet. We'll be back in just a minute with more Word of Mouth. From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Jamal Joseph's story is unlike many taught in schools during Black History Month. His long list of identifiers includes orphan, activist, FBI fugitive, convict, drug addict, urban guerrilla, and Black Panther. In a speech he made in the 1960s, Jamal urged students to burn down Columbia University. He's now a professor there, and a writer, filmmaker, Oscar nominee, youth advocate, drug counselor, and husband and father. His remarkable story of rebellion and reinvention comes to life in a new book called Panther Baby. The book is out today from Algonquin. Jamal Joseph, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I didn't hit on all the credits listed on your book jacket. Is there anything you haven't done, Jamal?
No, I'm not a very good cook, but no, let me correct that. From the Black Panther Party breakfast program, I do make great pancakes.
So you're even more well-rounded than we suspect.
Exactly.
Well, you know, you write about your early life, living with your foster parents / grandparents, Noonie and Pa, Baltimore in the Bronx. You're a studious kid, a church boy. So what was the draw of the Black Panthers for you?
Well, Noonie and Pa had, they were my adopted grandparents, and they took me in when they were quite old, which meant that they had been born in the previous century, in the 19th century. Their parents had been slaves. So I heard about slavery, lynching, firsthand from them. They talked about a South where a black person could not look a white person in the eye, where you had to get off the sidewalk if white people were coming down the sidewalk, lynching of relatives and of friends. They were active from Garvey's Back to Africa movement to the Civil Rights movement. So I grew up with this sense of social consciousness. Mm-hmm. And then joined the NAACP Youth Council when I was 13 years old. When I was 15 and Dr. King was killed, I was radicalized. I was angry and I wanted to join a militant organization, even though I wasn't quite sure what the term militant really meant, and sought out the Black Panther Party.
And you write in the book, and here I was, an orphan boy, a church boy, and an honor student with an M16 on my lap, pursuing the path to manhood. If it wasn't radicalization or armed insurrection, what was the Black Panther Party for you?
Well, the path to manhood speaks to not knowing my dad. I'd never met my father. Found out much later that he had actually fought alongside Fidel and Che in Cuba, and Pa Baltimore died when I was 12 years old. There's a thing in poor communities, in the black communities, about the men on the corner who have swagger, who are bad, that manhood. So the Panthers had swagger, and they stood up to the system, which is all that we knew. And we knew that we were mad at white people because Dr. King was killed. So we walked into the Panther office, myself and two older friends. We thought that we were joining an organization with plenty of swagger and that they would arm us to go out and avenge Dr. King. So I jumped up in the meeting and I said, choose me, brother, arm me. I'll kill a white dude right now. Yeah. And I was called up front, and the information lieutenant who was running the meeting, talking about the Panther 10-point program, by the way, and there's nothing in there about killing white people or going into the streets in that way. And he reached in, and I thought he was giving me a gun, and he gave me a stack of books. I said, I thought you were going to arm me. He said, I just did. Well, and he said, and by the way, if the racist cops that are beating people up, if they were all black and the people getting beat up were white, people getting shot, and the people in control of this oppressive government, if they were all black and the people being oppressed were white, would that make things correct? Would you feel better? And I said, no, it would still seem wrong. He said, that's right. This is about class struggle and human rights. Study those books so you understand what the revolution is about. So I kind of was drawn in by the charisma of the Panthers and then, you know, fortunately became a Panther, you know, as a result of the mentorship and what I learned. I say fortunately because kids join gangs these days looking for swagger, looking for family, and there is no one there saying, this is about being politically aware, this is going to be about community service, this is going to be about the real path to manhood and womanhood and family.
I get the sense in the book of that time. It's very alive that when, you know, armed revolution seemed possible, even inevitable, and weapons training was certainly part of your education, was armed insurrection the goal?
I think the goal was the awareness, the coming into awareness, the coming out of confusion into awareness and trying to figure it out, trying to figure out that awkward transition and that path to manhood. that's the voice that I wanted to write the book from, rather than someone who's a, you know, Columbia professor and looks back and, you know, has all of this insight and hindsight on what was going on. We were at an age where the youth was questioning adult culture and the politics of the country in general. And the Panthers talked about all power to the people, which meant power to all groups, to black people, to white people, to yellow people, to brown people. And you were in the room at, you know, at demonstrations, at college dorms, with students from a Democratic Society and the Young Lords Party and Asian radical groups and American Indian groups, and we were young. Mm-hmm. The average age of someone in the Black Panther Party was 19, 20 years old. Yeah. So we talked about this revolution. We talked about demanding a redistribution of the wealth. We talked about, you know, human rights and women's rights and all of those things. And we saw the government being repressive. It was clear it was happening in Vietnam. It was happening on college campuses. We had Mississippi State and Kent State where students were being shot down on college campuses. Forget what was happening in the black community when the police were raiding Panther homes and offices and murdering people like Fred Hampton. We felt that self-defense, which would lead to confrontation, was inevitable because of the government, because of the way that they were proceeding. But if you ask someone who was in the Black Panther Party and who was in the movement, what's the number one thing that it all boiled down to? What were you brainwashed to believe above all other things? And people will say something to the effect, we were taught to have an undying love for the people. We were taught to serve the people.
We're talking with Jamal Joseph. He's got a new book out today called Panther Baby, A Life of Rebellion and Reinvention. That was one of the profound things for me in the book, that this was about love. This was about love of community. And I think so many white Americans and probably black Americans as well have this very distorted picture about who the Panthers were, largely because, you know, the arrest. In fact, you were arrested in a dragnet of what became Panther 21. This was a famous case, charged for allegedly planning to go to war with the government. You were sentenced to 11 months at Rikers Island as a 16-year-old. Later, served 12 years at what you call Leavenworth University. So, what did you take away from this prison experience?
Well, what I found in prison is that a lot of what we talked about in terms of bringing people together came into play of, when I was able to unite my fellow prisoners. Through all things, you know, you might think it would be a hunger strike or some kind of resistance, but theater. I had done along the way some theater, first kind of political agitprop theater, and then took some classes and did some acting and, you know, some assisted directing on the outside. And it got out when I got in prison that I had done theater. There are no secrets, right? Guys came over and, you know, challenged me to write a play for Black History Month. Now, Leavenworth was segregated. Guys then, as they do now, stayed in their own sections of the yards. It's tough. And we're having rehearsal, and some of the leaders of the Mexican gangs came in. Mm-hmm. And we thought there was going to be a war. And they stood around. They looked really, really upset. Finally, one of the guys called me over, and this was a black cast I was working with. He says, you know, I don't mean to get into your business essay, but that guy's not feeling his character. So I rewrote the play, and it became a black and Latino play. The guys from the white court came up, and one of the guys came. His name is Rebel, and he came back to all of his guys, and he was 225 pounds and a black belt and, you know, pretty racist guy. And he came back down to his crew, and he said, did you go up there where the blacks and Mexicans were? And he said, yup. And he said, well, what are they doing? And he said, a play. They said, well, what did you do about it, Reb? He said, well, they give me a part. So we had a multicultural group. We had our own courtyard. And then people started writing their own stories, and guys invited each other to the college classes, and we started talking about our differences. And then I came to understood that the weapons of social change could be different. Bobby Seale, the founder of the Panther Party, says it in this way, that when the Panthers started in 66, Panthers patrolled the streets of Oakland with shotguns and law books because those were dynamic weapons of social change. The guns were legal. The law showed that the Panthers understood the right of the community to defend themselves from police brutality and from racist attacks. But Bobby said if they were starting the Panthers today, that Panthers would still be out on the street patrolling, but they'd be carrying video cameras and laptop computers because these are the weapons of social change.
Well, now you're a full professor at Columbia School of the Arts Film Program. You've been nominated for an Academy Award for your work on this song, Raise It Up. This was featured in the film August Rush. Now, how does that radical, impatient self, that activist, come across in teaching today?
Well, the work that I do with young people, Impact Repertory Theater, is a grassroots organization that I co-founded 14 years ago. And the idea was to get kids into a safe space and let them find voice through theater arts. And there's a leadership training component where we talk about what's going on in the community and in the world so that they, young people can learn to think critically. And we challenge them to do two things. One thing, they have to know what college that they're going to, whether they're 17 years old, 18 years old, 11 years old, and claim that, because we often don't claim that in poor communities as something that's absolutely going to happen. And the other is that we get them to claim that they're going to give service. So that work, that teaching, all of that really comes back to arts and education and understanding that a liberated mind is the most loving and powerful force on the planet.
Well, Jamal Joseph, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
No father figure in the house, and I'm wondering how I'm gonna work it out. Oh, my friends keep on telling me how I don't need that man, but they don't really understand. There's far too many
pressures. In the background, we're listening to the Academy Award-nominated song Raise It Up that earned an Oscar nomination for the writer, filmmaker, FBI fugitive, convict, Ivy League professor, husband, father, and playwright, Jamal Joseph. We have more on his book, Panther Baby, A Life of Rebellion and Reinvention, including a book trailer and some reviews. You'll find all that at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, an NPR producer turns documentary filmmaker to expose a long-held family secret. That's when Word of Mouth continues after the news.
So don't give up.
Don't give up.
Your pressure's coming down.
Sometimes it seems impossible, and that's why we pray.
So raise it up.
Seems to be nothing left for me. Mama's gone, Daddy didn't want to be. And now I'm all by myself.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
For word of mouth.
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 Well, that's much.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Every family has its secrets, few compared to the Lichtais. Steve Lichtai was adopted by a devout Roman Catholic family. Growing up in a small house on a Kansas farm, he was adored by his eight older siblings, adored and sheltered from a painful secret about his identity. And everyone in their small town knew the truth before he did.
I always assumed that you already knew, because the kids, our kids, would have told him. Oh. Well, that's strange.
Never
I can't
knew.
Believe they kept a secret like that for
well,
so long.
Well, and not only did they keep a secret, this is a small community. It was an open secret.
That's Steve talking to Don and Mary Jane Lichtai, the mother and father who raised him. Steve is a producer for NPR and now filmmaker. His documentary, Open Secret, was an official selection at the 2011 Hot Docs Film Festival in Toronto. And Steve Lichtai is with us now from NPR in Washington. Steve, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
So you had a pretty normal Midwestern childhood. Did you always know you were adopted?
Yeah, I did. When I was around 5 or 6, my parents set me down and said that we adopted you. And that was really the last of the discussion of that. I don't remember asking a lot of questions about it, but I know that I did, but I don't think it was something that was constantly on my mind. But it was definitely part of my history.
This film is your exploration of the secret of your adoption. Let's hear just a clip from Open Secret. Now, you return to your parents' farm to find out more, and you talk to some of your old friends who remember things about your childhood.
Did I talk at all about being adopted with you?
Just said that you were adopted and had no idea who your birth parents were. I remember, I don't know if you remember this, in maybe second, third grade, our plan was to buy a semi, go truck, and look for your parents while we were working.
I was of the school of thought that you can trust your parents, and I knew your parents, and I trusted them, but there are parts of it that just didn't seem feasible to me.
We heard first from your friend Vance, who said, we thought we'd had this fantasy of buying a semi and going looking for your parents. Well, when you came of age, you didn't do that, but what did happen at 18?
Well, at 18, the night before my high school graduation, Vance and Alan, who you both just heard there, they came to my house. They came into my bedroom, and Vance said, "There's something that we want to tell you." And I was surprised because they were so serious, and they weren't really serious guys. And I had no idea what they were about to tell me. And then, you know, Vance said to me, you know, we know who your mother is. And I said, you know, well, who? And they said, your sister. Your sister's your mother. I said, I think I might have asked, you know, which one? I don't even think I
right,
put
you
two
have
and two
several.
Together. Yeah, I have six sisters. So, and, you know, they said, well, Joni is your mother. And then I, from what I remember, which is a little vague, and from what I also, my friends, Alan and Vance both remember, is that I was instantly, you know, incredulous. And then I became sort of contemplative about it and trying to figure it out in my head how this could be possible. But I was shocked.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, at age 18, everyone's figuring out their identity. But for you, you know, there you were, right about to begin your new life. You know, we heard your mother a little earlier laughing it off. You know, I thought you knew, kind of minimizing right. a huge revelation that your parents were actually your grandparents. So do you think they got what this meant to you?
No, I mean, I don't. I think ultimately they did in the process of talking to them. There was a lot of self-preservation going on. Here. And, you know, this is 1969 Kansas in a very Catholic part of the country. And this is not something that you necessarily want to be out there that your oldest daughter got pregnant. But no, I don't think that they understood. You know, and the thing is, how could you understand it unless it actually happens to you? And it's one of these things where the age of 18 is not a great time to learn this information about yourself. Mm-hmm. It's a hugely pivotal moment in your life. And to be leaving high school and moving on to the next part and to have this sort of identity rug pulled out from under you is difficult. I had a hard time dealing with it for a good 10 or 12 years.
Well, I think we sort of watch you grow throughout this process, too. I'm guessing at when some of these conversations, or at least the chronology of some of them, there's one when your adoptive mother, Mary Jane, she responds to your questions about keeping the truth from you. Here's a little clip.
Well, what would you have preferred if you called us grandma, grandpa, or mom and dad?
It's not so much that. I wish you would have adopted me and said, by the way, we also happen to be your grandparents. Mm-hmm. But we adopted you because we love you and we want you to be in the family. I always think it's better to tell people that you're family.
Yeah.
Let's put it this way. I always think it's better to tell the truth.
Yeah.
And you guys didn't tell the truth.
Well, we just didn't tell.
Why are you being so stubborn about that point?
No. Well, it's not the lying when we didn't answer. Wasn't asked a question.
But I didn't know to ask about it.
Steve Lickteig's with us. He's a producer for NPR in Washington, now filmmaker, and we just heard a clip from his film called Open Secret. It documents his unraveling a really hurtful family secret that he grew up with, not knowing that his oldest sister was indeed his mother. Steve, it strikes me as so courageous of you, or maybe made me squirm to see her, this now tiny old lady who was described by all of your family as kind of imperious, you know, growing up.
Yeah.
How do you approach resolution when you and she see things so differently?
We never got resolution. I mean, that was a very frustrating interview with her. She would not admit that there was any lying. I mean, and I know lying is a very strong word, but that's what happened. But she calls it omission.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I'm not asking, how can they lie? And we never really did reach anything on that. There was no agreement that came from that. It was sort of agree to disagree moment. And that was hard to be sitting there across the table from her as an adult and her as an old, you know, she was in her 80s then.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought maybe she'd have a moment of, you know, you're right. We did keep something from you, and we're sorry, but that didn't happen.
And that moment never comes. And there's the point when your then-fiancé, Barry, very wisely says to you, you know, you might not get the resolution you're looking for. This might not turn out to be the, I don't know, catharsis that you're looking for.
She had really great insight. I mean, I think as only someone from outside looking in could, that I wanted all these threads to be woven together perfectly and for everybody to come together and say, I was wrong, I'm sorry. Not only to me, but to each other, Mary Jane, my mother, to Joni, my birth mother, to have them come together and sort of get their stories aligned. And my fiance, now wife, Barry, just says, that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
That's not going to happen. You need to find a way to move on from that.
We're going to hear a conversation with you and your birth mother, Joni, also your oldest sister. What did you want from her?
I wanted to know a lot of things. I wanted to know what she was thinking when she got pregnant, what her plan was for herself and for me when she found out she was pregnant, and why she felt the need to go along with the plan that my parents had constructed
And about your father, I think. We learned
and my father, who I didn't find out about him until I was almost 30 years old. I mean, I knew that, she, you know, obviously Joni knew who he was because she had been with him, but she didn't know anything about him. And I didn't find out about his past until I was 30 years old.
There are several conversations you have with Joni in the film. Here's a clip from just one of them from the film Open Secret.
You're my mother, and I understand that, but you're also my sister. And
no,
you
I'm
are,
not your sister.
You are, by law.
No.
Yes, you are.
I am not your sister.
Legally, you are my sister.
But biologically, I am not your sister.
Right.
And there's a difference between that. I am sorry.
But we were raised to believe.
Oh, I know you were.
You know, Steve, it strikes me in this film a lot of impasses like this and deeply burrowed resentments, I think, on her part especially. Mm-hmm. You could have been rageful about this, but I'm really struck by your compassion for the players, you know, even though they were so close to you and it was so weighted for you. How did you get there?
It took a while, to be honest with you. I mean, when I said I found out at 18 and then in my 20s were kind of this mess of just keeping everything sort of locked in and not dealing with it. You know, my family didn't talk about this until I came home, 17 or 18 years later with the camera. So we had never discussed this secret as a family. At that point, I was ready to just know the truth. I did not go home and start making this film to bring about accusations. It was simply to uncover the truth, and I used the camera as a way of getting people to take what I was doing seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of worked in the sense that they did take it very seriously and they really wanted to talk, and also to give them a very respectful and professional space to do that talking in. And I was able to get at a lot of reasons, and you know, I uncovered all of these repressions and all of these worries and concerns that I didn't even know existed. I now have such understanding as to why this decision was made and why it was kept from me. I totally get it now. And it took me the process of making the film to get to that point. And listen, there was some, you know, I was angry occasionally, but I tried to not let that show in my interviews. I know that makes for more dramatic mm-hmm, filmmaking, yeah. possibly, but that's not what I tried to do or wanted to do in the making of the film. I wanted it to be a respectful place where people could just tell their story without being told, no, that's wrong, or that you're lying.
How can listeners see the film?
Well, it's one of these incredible stories of documentary filmmaking where there's a slow rollout situation. It's been in a couple of festivals. It's been broadcast in Israel, Israeli television. It'll be in Sweden in a few months. And I'm trying to find an American distributor to be able to get it onto DVD.
Well, short of going to Israel or Sweden, we will look out for it. And we really thank you, Steve Lichtai, for a very honest and unflinching film.
Thank you very much.
Steve Lichtai is a producer for NPR. His documentary is called Open Secret. Now, you can watch an extended trailer of the film and find out more about it at wordofmouthradio.org. And our thanks to Jack Rodolico for his help in producing this segment. You can also follow Word of Mouth on Facebook and on Twitter. From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott.
You are absolutely superb, beautiful lineup. Thank you very much. May I have the beagle?
Yes, the beagle!
Sound there from the 2008 Westminster Kennel Club dog show, when the top prize of Best in Show was awarded to Uno, a statuesque beagle. On Monday, Westminster kicks off its 136th contest in front of a packed house at New York's Madison Square Garden and no shortage of bemused TV watchers. Many are mystified by competitive dog handling. While prepping for this segment, we here at Word of Mouth realize that the bulk of our show dog knowledge stems from the mockumentary Best in Show, directed by Christopher Guest.
What do you see in front of me? What do you see in front of me? You see a big blue ribbon. It's right here in front of you. You want it? You come and you grab it. You get it.
She's not listening to you. She's nervous. She's freaking out.
Well, get the busy bee. You want your busy bee. You get your busy bee.
You get the busy bee. I need to trim her whiskers.
Michael Hitchcock and Parker Posey there as neurotic dog handlers Meg and Hamilton Swan. Here to expand on the amusing stereotypes is Josh Dean, author of Show Dog, The Charmed Life and Trying Times of a Near-Perfect Purebred. Josh, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
Josh, you're a dog person, or at least your publicity packet says so. Were you familiar with the show dog circuit?
Only in as much as you were. I mean, the bulk of my knowledge honestly came from Best in Show, too. I would watch Westminster most every year just because I like watching cute dogs run around in a circle, but I didn't really know what was going on. Best in Show turned out to be, it's obviously a mockumentary, but as one breeder told me, it's almost too close to reality.
Mm. You spent a year alongside Jack, an Australian Shepherd, and a rising star. What made him the dog to follow for you to find out more about this dog show universe?
You know, I had the idea and was determined to do this book, but I was almost paralyzed by the idea of choosing one particular dog. But I befriended a handler team out in Pennsylvania, husband-wife, named Heather Bremer and Kevin Bednar. And they handled the kind of dogs I liked, which were sporting dogs and herding dogs and sort of athletic, medium to large-sized dogs. And I went out to a show, and Jack just sort of chose me.
Well, we read about Jack's story in the book and the eccentric and really fascinating, sometimes treacherous, behind the grooming stand look at the show circuit. Now, first, the dog handlers and owners can be in thousands of shows across the country and the world each year. So what does that involve for them?
It's unbelievable. I mean, these people are really underappreciated, I think. I think when people hear that there's this culture of dog professional dog handlers, like, oh, that's what kind of joke of a job is that? But these are people who are almost never home. There's dog shows 50 to 52 weeks a year. Sometimes these shows run from Wednesday to Sunday, sometimes Thursday to Sunday. They have to travel between destinations. I mean, Heather and Kevin, the couple that I followed, they may be home some months, 2 days. And when they're on the road, they are up at sunrise with dogs, because at a given weekend, a successful handler team or a solo handler will have somewhere between 8 and 20 dogs under their care. Each of those dogs needs to be walked and watered and fed and exercised and groomed and primped and trained. And they barely have time to eat meals, honestly. It's an incredibly arduous job.
And these temp cities of, you know, RVs and minivans, people reading publications like the Lhasa Apso Reporter, Schnauzer Shorts, and Chin Chin Chats. You also write about, you know, a kind of the curated selection of T-shirt slogans observed at dog shows. Any favorites come to mind right offhand?
I mean, all the wiener dog T-shirts are funny. That's kind of an easy pun. Okay. But,
I loved dog hair, the other condiment.
Yeah, dog show people revel in kind of the filth, and they seem to appreciate the dogs are dogs, and the hair and the drool and the excrement. It's all like a joke and part of the fun to them.
Well, that's part of the question for me. I mean, let's pull back the curtain a little bit on the dog show. I've always wondered how handlers make sure that the dog actually does its business before the show, meaning not
yeah, there's an art to that. Some of it is managing their intake so that you can manage the out, what comes out. Mm-hmm. Dogs can be trained to do anything. I mean, they were a human invention. They like to make us happy. And one of those things is at least mostly learning to go to the bathroom on command or on schedule, which is not to say that there aren't accidents. Accidents are a hazard of the dog show world, and it's even happened at Westminster Under the Lights.
And they're very high-stakes shows. There's a lot of strategy that you write about, a lot of tension, a lot of setbacks, and cheating. Now, what does it mean to cheat in a dog show?
Really what it means to cheat is any alteration of the dog. I mean, the AKC rulebook says that you're not supposed to alter the appearance, so the dog should look, in theory, like it's supposed to look if it weren't touched by humans, so you can wash and dry it. But that said, go to a dog show and everyone is using hairspray. You know, hairspray and chalk would be the two most common things that really are permitted. And a judge is allowed to dismiss you from the ring if, say, he pats the side of the dog and white chalk dust sprays out. So usually handlers are pretty good about putting chalk in so that it doesn't reveal itself.
They can't use hairspray?
You're not supposed to. But yeah, I mean, look at a Bichon or look at a poodle. I mean, mm-hmm. these are dogs that are hairsprayed like the cats of Jersey Shore. I mean, unbelievably poofed out. So it's really like it's a rule that no one honors. That said, there is cheating. I mean, they're on the bad side, you'll have surgeries to, if a tail doesn't set itself quite right, they can clip muscle in the tail. You'll see prosthetics put into ears to make them stick up, prosthetic testicles even in dogs, because dogs have to be fully intact, as they say.
Mm-hmm.
In England, there's a big problem with dying dogs. So poodles, especially black poodles, tend to gray as they get older. And now at Crufts, the big show, they've started actually hair testing dogs to be sure they're not dyed.
Wow. Reality TV shows that are now about pageant moms, you know, with toddlers spray tanned and in full-blown makeup, they're getting a lot of attention from watch groups as a form of abuse. Is there any kind of protest groups eyeing dog shows for abuse?
PETA seems to show up at Westminster every so often, but their issues are a little unclear. I mean, they're to some degree against pedigree dogs in general. I mean, certainly puppy mills have given purebreds a bad name. Puppy mills are horrible, but responsible breeders are actually doing a very good job to maintain healthy breed stocks. I actually have a chapter about do dogs enjoy dog shows, and I talked to some dog psychologists and people who study behavior. What most people will tell you is that dogs want to make people happy. Dogs like to play games and be given jobs. And a dog show is really either a game or a job. And if the dog does its job correctly, it gets praise and treats and love. And it gets to spend all day with other dogs. So, which isn't to say that there probably aren't some bad handlers who mistreat dogs. And if that's the case, then that's terrible. But the people I spent time around treated the dogs really well. The dogs seemed very happy. The owners seemed very happy. I mean, they don't like losing, but the nice thing is the dogs don't care if they lose.
The most wins by a group at Westminster has gone to terriers so far, 45 wins. Now, the next group, sporting dogs, have only 19. Is there a bias among judges?
It certainly seems that terriers and then poodles are the breeds that tend to do best. But that probably has a little bit to do with judge preference. It probably has more to do with the fact that poodles and terriers have a stage presence that a lot of other breeds do not. They seem to like to perform under the lights, and there's a little bit of an unpredictability about them that I think judges want to see personality, because at the end of the day, the 10 or 12 or 15 or 7 in Best in Show dogs in front of a judge are all pretty close to perfect. So the judge has to find the one thing that's going to make one of those dogs stand out, and personality is often that thing.
Well, it might be dispiriting for other dog owners. But, Josh, we want to thank you for a little bit of an insider's view. Appreciate your time.
Always happy to talk about dogs.
Josh Dean, author of Show Dog, The Charmed Life and Trying Times of a Near-Perfect Purebred. There are links to his book and much more on the Westminster Kennel Club show. That's kicking off next week. That's all at wordofmouthradio.org. And we'd love to hear from you. You can share your thoughts on puppies, purebreds, pampering, and dog shows. Is it good, clean fun, or something else entirely? And we continue our doggy debauchery with something we came across around the same time last year. Slate culture editor John Swansburg wrote about the accidental poetry of the American Kennel Club breed descriptions, meaning the standards used to judge breeds at Westminster and other dog shows. John's article inspired us to try out a few for ourselves, so we headed into the studio with a copy of the AKC guide and a few willing voices.
The most distinguishing characteristics of the Labrador Retriever are its short, dense, weather-resistant coat, an otter tail, a clean-cut head with broad back skull and moderate stop, powerful jaws, and its kind, friendly eyes expressing character, intelligence, and good temperament. Above all, a Labrador Retriever must be well-balanced, enabling it to move in the show ring or work in the field with little or no effort. The typical Labrador possesses style and quality without over-refinement.
Neck is strong, of moderate length, slightly arched at the crest, fitting well into the shoulders. Back is straight and strong, level and firm from withers to hip joints. The croup is moderately sloped. Chest is not broad, but is deep, with the lowest point reaching the elbow. The ribs are well sprung and long, neither barrel-chested nor slab-sided. The underline shows a moderate tuck-up. Tail is straight, docked, or naturally bobbed, not to exceed 4 inches in length.
To attain a well-proportioned head, which must be in balance with the rest of the dog, it embodies the following. Expression. The expression is intelligent, alert, soft and appealing. Eyes. Eyeballs are round and full and look directly forward. The shape of the eye rims gives a slightly almond-shaped appearance. The eye is not weak or goggled. The color of the iris is dark brown, and in general, the darker the better. Ears. Lobular, long, of fine leather, well feathered, and placed no higher than aligned the lower part of the eye. Skull. Rounded but not exaggerated, with no tendency toward flatness. The eyebrows are clearly defined, with a pronounced stop.
Jonathan Smith, Jan-Erik Asplund, and senior producer Rebecca Lavoie there, reading breed standards of the Labrador Retriever, the Australian Shepherd, and the Cocker Spaniel, respectively. So what do you think? Poetic? Persnickety? Inspiring? We'd love to hear your thoughts or your own interpretations. Dog lovers or no? You can post a comment on our Facebook page or send a tweet to @wordofmouth. Thanks so much for spending some time in our canine reverie today. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Virginia Prescott, and senior producer Rebecca Lavoie, with oversight and direction
from Abby Goldstein, NHPR's Vice President of Programming,
and web support from Brady Carlson
and Courtney Kenya.
Andrew Perella gives technical support.
And Dan Colgan. Dan the man runs our board.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individual,
not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters.
Really, anybody else.
For information about the show, to listen to past segments, post a comment, or read our blog,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
Or use the On Demand tab on the NHPR app.
You can join our community of listeners on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
And you can follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.